We have been working our way through John's Gospel. And today we come to John chapter 8. And John 8 presents us with kind of a unique text. If you have a translation that is not either the King James or the New King James, then you'll most likely see something like this as the end of chapter 7 and chapter 8 begins. And it simply states that the earliest manuscripts and many other ancient witnesses do not have this text here in John's Gospel. When I was in graduate school many, many years ago, I studied textual criticism. And one of the things in textual criticism that you do is you look at the old manuscripts and you compare them to see what was in the original text. And almost all scholars agree that it's not that this is not a story about Jesus. It's just that most likely John didn't place it here. You'll notice that some ancient manuscripts will have it over at the end of John's Gospel. Others will actually put it in the Gospel of Luke. And scholars who have examined the language of the text, many of them say that it looks more like it was written by Luke than it was written by John. Regardless of all of that debate, I believe that this is a story about Jesus. I believe it's inspired. And I believe that if it wasn't written by John, it was placed here in John because it tells a story that fits into the longer narrative of John's Gospel. You know, there are moments in life that define us. In 1914, there was a young baseball player who signed with a minor league team called the Baltimore Orioles. He had grown up in a reform school of all places, spending his both childhood and his teenage years at this Catholic reform school. And while there at the reform school, one of the brothers, he thought that one way that young men could learn discipline was by playing baseball. And so he had organized a reform school baseball team, and they would play throughout the Baltimore, Maryland area. And as this young man developed as a baseball player, some of the minor leagues noticed, and that's when the Orioles grabbed him. A few months later, the Boston Red Sox noticed this young man, and so they made a trade to that minor league team, and they brought a guy by the name of George Herman Ruth up to the majors. Now, what made George Ruth such a good baseball player was he was an awesome left-handed pitcher. And so in 1915, he didn't play much in 1915. He pitched several games, but he was very successful. And in 1916, they began to use him a little bit more. And as they used him a little bit more, they noticed that not only could he pitch, but boy, he could hit a ball a long way. By 1917, Babe Ruth was playing full-time. He had moved from being a pitcher to either being infielder or an outfielder, and he was starting to knock home runs just almost every game. By 1919, when he was just, you know, about 24 years old, he had set the Major League Baseball home run record for that year. And the Red Sox were on fire. They had won 3 World Series in 5 years. And so when you've got a team that's red hot and you've got a player that's knocking them out of the park, what do you do? And the owner of the Red Sox said, "You sell him." And that's what they did. In December of 1919, they sold Babe Ruth to the New York Yankees for $100,000. Now, y'all, that's a lot of money today. In 1919, it was mind-boggling. And yet, while everybody at the time thought, "Wow, what a deal the Red Sox got for this young baseball player," history would prove right the opposite. You see, the Red Sox, who had won 3 World Series in 5 years, would not win another World Series for 86 years, 2004. It was called the curse of the Bambino. I mean, how do you trade Babe Ruth and survive? And the answer was, you didn't. The New York Yankees would go on. Today, I think they've won, I think it's somewhere, 26, 27 World Series. You can take all the rest of the next like 7 or 8 teams, and they still wouldn't be where the Yankees are. Now, you would think, well, okay, the curse of the Bambino. I mean, yes, it affected the Red Sox, but it didn't just affect the Red Sox. It affected another baseball player by the name of Bill Buckner. Bill Buckner was a guy who started playing baseball in 1969. He played for several different teams, including the Red Sox. He was a great baseball player. In fact, 1980 won the National League Baseball Batting Average Award. And so here was just this good all-around baseball player. He came to the Red Sox and was with the Red Sox in 1986. Red Sox were just hoping somehow to break the curse of the Bambino. As the series kept going on against the Red Sox and the New York Mets, the Red Sox eventually got up on them 3-2. And in the 6th game, it looked like finally the curse would be broken. They went back and forth, they went back and forth. The Mets eventually tied them in the 9th inning, sending the game to the 10th. In the 10th inning, the Red Sox batted first and got up 2 runs. On television, it was already showing, you know, World Series champions, the Boston Red Sox, most valuable player. I mean, they were already starting to flash what they expected to come. You got to the bottom of the 10th. The Red Sox got 2 players out, only 1 out left. Batter was at the plate. It was 2-1. And he hit a single. And then the next batter came up and he hit a single. And then the next batter came up and he hit a single. And the people in the crowd began to go, no, not again, not again. We just need 1 out, 1 out. The next batter would come up, he'd hit a single. Red Sox would then watch as the Mets, one of their players came in. Now they're ahead by just 1 run. And so they quickly switched pitchers and brought another pitcher in. And he began, and unfortunately, his second or third throw went awry, and the catcher didn't catch it, and the ball went behind him, and the tying run came to the plate. Now with 2 men on, 2 outs, bottom of the 10th, the Red Sox have got to get another out. And so Mookie Wilson comes to the plate. Mookie fouls off several balls in a row, and then finally he hits one that goes right down first baseline where Bill Buckner was playing. All Buckner's got to do is reach down, grab the ball, touch the bag, and they'll go into the 12th inning or the 11th inning. About a month before this, they had interviewed Bill Buckner on television. They said, "What's your greatest dream?" He said, "Winning World Series." "What's your worst nightmare?" He said, "Oh, worst nightmare is being in the World Series and letting a ball go between your legs and losing the entire World Series because of it." He would prove to be a prophet. The ball would go just right of his glove as he went down, went right through his legs into the outfield. The Mets scored. They won that game. They came back the next night. And they won it, and they won the World Series. But it was what happened to Bill Buckner that was so sad. You see, everybody basically did this. Here's the ball as it's coming to him, going between his legs. And then the Mets named him their 1986 World Series MVP. Y'all, that's the wrong team, by the way. Buckner would continue to play the next year. Red Sox would trade him. From then on, he just became the curse. The curse of the Bambino had moved to Buckner. When he came back at the end of his career to play one last time with the Red Sox, The people still hadn't forgiven him. I saw an interview of him and his wife on the 25th anniversary. And they talked about how that one moment had defined their whole lives. How people would make just ugly comments. How people had made death threats. How people had blamed him. Not the pitcher who threw the wild pitch. Not the catcher who had missed the ball. Not the team who couldn't win Game 7. They had blamed Bill Buckner. You see, there are moments in our lives that we wish just for a second we could somehow go back and snatch them so that they wouldn't have occurred. And that's what you have here in John chapter 8. You have Jesus as he at dawn goes back to the temple. He gathers there the people around him. He sits down to teach them. And this story is just a very neat little tight-knit story about how that the Pharisees and the scribes come up, and with them is a woman who they have caught in the act of adultery. And they drag her to Jesus, and you can almost picture the scene there in the temple courts as Jesus sees them coming with this woman, and they made her stand before the group. I want you to look at that. I've tried this last week just to place myself in the shoes of this woman. What was it like to be in a moment where, yes, you know you shouldn't have been there, and the next thing you know, the doors fling open, you're dragged out of the bed, you're dragged through the street, you're carried to the temple, and then you're made to stand in front of everyone? I would have crumpled to the ground in tears. I remember my own dad saying to me when I was a teenager, "You ever get arrested, don't you call me." And he meant it. And if I'd gotten arrested, I don't know who I would have called, but it wouldn't have been Dad. And here's this woman who she had been arrested. And where's she going to turn? I can't imagine what was racing through her mind. I'm sure she knew that her life would never be the same. I suspect she thought, "They're going to kill me. It's all over." I would love to know if she ever asked herself, "What about the man? Why didn't they take him?" Jesus, as they're sitting there asking him, this is what the law says, Deuteronomy 22:22. If a man is found sleeping with another man's wife, both the man who slept with her and the woman must die. Interesting, isn't it? How that we can leave out part of the text and it'd be all right. Where was the man? Was he that fast? Was he that strong? Or did he simply have that much money? Needless to say, he wasn't there. And so Jesus did what I guess you and I would do. They're using this in order to trap him. That's something that we're very familiar with in the Gospels, whether it's taking a denarius and asking, should we pay taxes to Caesar or not, or asking Jesus about a woman who had been married to 7 brothers, whose wife will she be in the resurrection? They were constantly trying to trap him. And yet Jesus didn't fall for the trap. He simply bent down and began to write on the ground. One of those great stories in the Bible, because if you open up the commentaries, here's what's amazing. Most commentaries are more concerned with what Jesus was writing on the ground than what Jesus was teaching in the story. In fact, you can just read all kinds of guesses as to what Jesus was writing. Can I just tell you what he was writing? We don't know. Don't waste your time. But what we do know is that the men kept asking him, you know, what do you say? What are we supposed to do with her, you friend of sinners? And we all remember the story. Let any of you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her. The law actually said that the person who was the witness was the one who was to throw the first stone. But anybody who is without sin, why don't you just throw the stone? And we know what the story says at this, beginning with the oldest and going to the youngest, they one by one walked away until it was only Jesus and the woman standing there. And that's when Jesus spoke to her for the first time and when she spoke to him. one of the shortest conversations recorded in Scripture. As Jesus turns to her and says, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" I know she felt that way. She thought it's all over. Has no one condemned you? And for the first time, and I can't help but wonder how her voice sounded. I mean, could you hear her fear in her voice as she spoke up, not knowing how Jesus would respond to her? And she said, "No one, sir." Three words. No one. And then Jesus says, "Then neither do I condemn you." Can I ask you a question? How do you think Jesus said that? What was the look of His eyes? I mean, have you ever noticed how people communicate with their eyes? My mom, when I was a kid growing up in church, if I wasn't doing something I wasn't supposed to do, Mom could just turn her eyes and look at me and it'd scare me half to death. Y'all know what I'm talking about. And to this day, June's got a look. I know y'all think she's the most gentle, easygoing woman in the world. But I got to tell you that June worked for like 15 years in a library as a librarian's assistant. And let me tell you that she's got it down pat. I'm telling you. She can give you the look, and I mean, and you think she would leave it at school. Oh no, she brings it home. But she never uses it on me. Isn't that great? Jesus then looks at her and says, "You need to go." And I know she was wanting to get out of there. "Go. But leave your life of sin. Go. But if you're looking for love, can I point you in a different direction? Can I tell you of someone who will love you, who won't use you, who won't abuse you, who won't cause you to live in shame?" I can't help but think that Jesus' words were as tender as any words this woman had ever heard. We come to a topic here that is so very, very important. The word that is used there, both of Jesus in describing the religious leaders and Himself, is the Greek word katakrino. And it's a compound word made up of kata, meaning down, and krino, meaning to judge. And so it means to judge down. And if you remember movie Gladiator, there's a scene there where the emperor is at the Colosseum and the gladiators are fighting. And finally the question is, will he die or not? And the emperor stands up with his thumb like this. And you remember the story. The crowd's all either saying, "Yes, let him live," or "No, let him die." And in many ways, that's the image that you get here with Jesus as His hand is out and He says, "Then neither do I condemn you." That's not what you're going to get. You're not going to get a thumbs down from me. But you need to leave your life of sin. Jeremiah in his prophecy says, "We acknowledge our wickedness, Lord, and the guilt of our ancestors." One of the things as preachers sometimes that we have to deal with is this question, are we responsible for the sins of our ancestors? And can I suggest to you that whether it's Jeremiah or Daniel or others of the prophets, that they oftentimes not just confess their sins, but the sins of their ancestors. I remember growing up in the South in the 60s. And in the community that I grew up in, There was a Church of Christ, but about 2 miles was another Church of Christ. And one Church of Christ was for Anglos, and one Church of Christ was for African Americans. And even though I grew up in a community where I didn't hear racism in a very just in-your-face form, you couldn't help but go to church and hear and feel racism when you knew that this Church of Christ was for the white people and the other Church of Christ was for the black people. And yes, we could say all day long that God had created us equally, and that there's no male or female, there's no slave or free, there's no black and white, except in our church. And while I heard good people preach against racism, I saw them practice it every Sunday. We sometimes inherit sin that we don't even see. And whether it was racism or judgment. You see, I was raised in a culture in churches of Christ where not only did we all have it right, but everybody else had it all wrong. And because I had it right and they had it wrong, then I could judge them. And I'm not talking about saying I disagree with your doctrine. I'm talking about saying you can't be saved. And if there's anything that goes on in John's gospel, John is trying to get across that Jesus did not come into the world to judge the world. I don't know if you ever noticed that. We quote John 3:16, but can I tell you that if there was a verse that churches of Christ needed to memorize, it was John 3:17? Of where Jesus said, "For God did not send His Son into the world to condemn the world, to judge it. He sent it to save it." And even though we taught as I was growing up that we were a people of the book, I was always amazed at the parts of the book that we didn't want to be the people of. You see, I never heard a sermon on Matthew 7, 1 and 2. Mark 16, 16, Acts 2, 38. I mean, Romans 10, 9 and 10, yes, we preached on those all the time. But somehow we just overlooked this one, where Jesus is just as plain and as clear as He can be. Judge not. And I don't know how growing up we could hear passages like that and continue to treat our fellow human beings the way we treated them. Now, Jesus wasn't saying that we need to throw caution to the wind, but what He was saying is that those of us who have a beam in our eye, by the way, which is probably all of us, need to be careful before we go and try to remove speck out of our friend's eyes. I mean, He would go on to say, don't give to dogs what is sacred or throw your pearls to pigs, which is simply another way of saying you don't throw common sense to the wind. Of course, you're fruit inspectors. Of course, we can look at what other people, you know, what they believe and look at the consequences of that. But to pass judgment on them simply is not what God gives us the right to do. John 5:22, Jesus says very clearly, "The Father judges no one." Why? Because He has entrusted all judgment to the Son. By the way, I want you to notice up there, that's all judgment, not part of it. Not some of it. He doesn't give you a piece of it, me a piece of it. It all belongs to Jesus. In fact, Paul would say in Romans chapter 14 that we all are going to appear before the judgment seat of Christ, and therefore we need to get out of the judging business. And how dare we show contempt to our brother and sister? Because you see, when you're a judge sitting up here and you're looking down at the one that you're judging, then you are in a natural state of showing contempt, which is simply to treat someone downward, as if they're not as good as you are. Paul would say in Athens that Jesus, God has appointed a day in which He's going to judge everyone, and He's going to judge them through Jesus. And so when you come to John's gospel, he said, "The problem with you is that you judge by human standards." And then notice what Jesus says, "I pass judgment on no one." Jesus never judged the eternity of an individual with the exception of Judas Iscariot. Everyone else, He simply didn't pass judgment on. He would pass judgment on the Pharisees in general, but not all Pharisees, such as Nicodemus. He didn't judge the woman at the well. He didn't judge the invalid who wouldn't put his faith in Him. He didn't judge a woman who had been caught in the very act of adultery. I mean, the woman didn't deny her sin. She didn't say, I didn't do it. She didn't say it was a mistake. But Jesus still did not judge her. And one of the things that you see in the text, Jesus saying, if anyone hears my words but does not keep them, I do not judge that person. Wait a minute, what do you mean, Jesus? Someone judges them, yes, but not right now. You see, there's the problem. Jesus goes on to say, there is a judge for the one who rejects me and does not accept my word. The very words I've spoken will judge him on the last day, not today. Brothers and sisters, there are moments that define us. And those moments are too special for us to sit in the seat of Jesus Christ and to act like we know what's in a person's heart, what their life's trajectory is, and what they're going to end up doing before they die, and then pronounce judgment on them. We don't have that right. In fact, it is absolutely condemned by Jesus Himself. And if we're ever going to be a church that makes a difference in this community, we have somehow got to overcome the reputation that unfortunately has dogged us forever. You think Bill Buckner got a bad deal? We've had a far worse deal because of the behavior of some of us, including me, in the past. You see, we make bad judges because, number one, when you judge by nature, you show contempt. It's just that simple. Paul, as he's saying to the Romans, he says, why do you treat them with contempt? You see, anytime I'm up here and you're down there, that's contempt. And so, number one, what I create is a spirit that's not a healthy spirit. Number two, I'm only judging by human standards. And that's the best that I have to offer. Now, I know some of you are thinking, but Leslie, what do you do when you disagree with someone's doctrine? You talk about it. They knocked on my door. I invited them in. They were two Mormon missionaries, 18, 19, 20 years old. They were doing their years of service. I introduced myself, told them that I was a preacher for the Churches of Christ. They had heard of us. And so one of the young men looked at me and he said, can I ask you a question? I said, sure. He says, do you think we're going to be lost? I told him, I said, I hope not. But I said, I've got to tell you that I struggle with some of your doctrine big time. He wasn't offended by that statement. He said, do you mind telling me which? And I said, well, the fact that you believe that God has a wife and is married. You see, in Mormon doctrine, God is married. He has a wife. The youngest of the two men looked at me and he says, we don't believe God's married. And I said, yes, you do. And he turned to his friend and he says, we don't believe that, do we? And he said, yeah, we do. And the young man looked at him and said, when did we start believing that? Kind of tells you what is hidden from even people within their own faith. You see, you can disagree with people without being disrespectful to them. And you can share where your heart is. I told them, I said, I would love for you to be saved. But there's some doctrines that you hold that just absolutely scares the daylights out of me. You see, we need to be a people that when we are in contact with people in the world, we may get one shot at them. And that one shot may define how they look at us and how they respond to the gospel of Jesus Christ. We got to recognize we're limited in our ability to make judgment calls. Can I ask you a question? Was the woman saved? When she walked away, was she saved? You see, some people will say, of course she was saved. Jesus says, I don't condemn you. Yes, but neither did he say, your sins are forgiven, like he did on other occasions. Well, then she must have been lost. No, he didn't say that either. You see, Jesus did to her what we need to do with all of those that we come in contact with. He didn't call it one way or the other. You see, he didn't come into the world to condemn the world, but to save it. And so he said to her, I'm not going to condemn you, but you're going to have to find a better way of living. And we don't know what choice she made. I think that's intentional. I think basically Jesus was simply saying, would all of us put ourselves in her place? And realize that how Jesus treated this woman taken in adultery was a moment that defined her life. And how we treat others may be a moment that defines their lives. So can we be Jesus to them? Can we be people that love them, that refuses to condemn them, and that points them to the one who can save them? That's what God has called us to. I don't know where you are today. You may find yourselves in the case of the woman who is taken in adultery. I'm not saying you've committed adultery. I'm just saying you may find yourself in a sin that's kept you from God. And I would simply say that Jesus offers you the same love that he offered that woman. He's not here to condemn you. He's here to save you. And he saves you by you putting your faith in him and being born again of water and the Spirit. And if you haven't done that, please do it today and claim that wonderful salvation he offers.